Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and welcome to the Ghibliotech, the podcast that curates the collection of films from the world's greatest animation studio, Studio Ghibli. I'm Michael Leader, and I've seen a lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm gradually building my very own custom Ghibli Panini sticker album.
So join us on our live quest into the glorious world of Ghibli. So Jake, we're back here once more introducing our final British Museum live discussion.
The live tour has to end sometime. We're not Bob Dylan, are we?
Exactly. And we're ending on quite a film to talk about.
Yeah, I know that listeners may be thinking, didn't they just talk about this one? But This conversation in a way made me think, well, we barely scratched the surface.
Exactly. So this is The Wind Rises, which was one of the final episodes of the previous miniseries. But even within that episode, I think we said that this is a film that was going to take residence in our brains for some time, and we couldn't talk about it in that usual 15-minute segment.
Immediately after watching The Wind Rises, it felt like the film, from all the ones that we've seen, that I'd most like to go straight back into and learn more about and see how it would change and become more rewarding the more that you watch it.
Exactly. And what a panel we had. So Nicole Roumanier, who was on our My Neighbor Totoro episode, was back once again. She's the curator of the manga exhibition at the British Museum, which this screening was in support of. But our second guest was someone we've had in mind for some time. It's Alex Dudoktovit, who I remember way back when he first started his career writing about animation for Sight and Sound. He wrote some wonderful pieces on Isao Takahata, their obituary for him. But since then, he's just recently been appointed the Europe editor of Cartoon Brew, which is an essential news and opinion resource for the animation industry. And maybe he first publicly mentions this on our podcast, so it's an exclusive, but he has a book coming out. He's writing a book on Grave of the Fireflies for the BFI Classics series
If we ever do a redux, once we've truly run out of episodes and have to do all of these films again, Grave of the Fireflies, I think we know who to call.
If we want to put ourselves through that again. My soul can only take so many viewings of that film, Jake. But anyway, this is a fantastic discussion full of insight into what is quite a thorny and knotty film. But before we throw to that, just want to say once more thank you to Bryony Smith and Freddie Matthews, who put together this program and asked us to come down and talk about Ghibli in front of the audience. And if you were there at any of these screenings, thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, and if you're one of those people that caught Michael in a stage dive, we really appreciate it.
We're so honoured to be asked to host these Q&As, and this is, you know, very sadly the last of the run of four we've done, but we do have an amazing panel of experts here to talk about The Wind Rises. We have Nicole Roumanier, the lead curator of the manga exhibition, which is running here at the British Museum until the end of the month. And we have Alex Dudoktovit, animation expert, writer for Sight and Sound, Europe editor of Cartoon Brew. And we can talk about your book now, can't we? Do you want to give a mention to your book? Because this is the sort of room you can plug it to.
So I've just started writing a book on the bleakest of all the Ghibli films, Grave of the Fireflies.
Any Grave of the Fireflies fans in the room? Yes.
Is that a film you can whoop?
This is the sort of room where it wouldn't get a whoop. Yeah. So who here was watching The Wind Rises for the first time tonight? Wow, a lot of first viewers. Were you Ghibli fans beforehand, or was this the first time you were? Okay, cool. So you're digging deeper into the canon, as we have in the podcast so far. But we can dig deeper into the film now, can't we?
Yeah, absolutely. So, Nicole, you were here for the first episode of this series on My Neighbor Totoro, so it's lovely to have you back for this one. We're bookending with a Miyazaki film. And how was it for you revisiting this film and seeing it now after the journey that we've been on?
Well, I have to say that it's incredibly powerful, and I found myself just completely absorbed. I can't tell you how many times I've seen this film, but first of all, maybe seeing it here, seeing it, you know, in this context after, you know, these four sets of films, and having it finally as the ending, I think it's perfect. I think it's compelling seeing it, you know, as many times, but seeing it on this very big screen for the first time, actually, I started to actually see some of the signs of the buildings. You could start to identify things. It just makes you deeper and further in. And then, I don't know, I've come without, to be honest, at the first, I love this film. Then I had a little bit of a problem with it. I love it again. So I'm very, very happy.
Yeah. Could you take us on that journey, liking, not so liking, and of then course. Coming back around? What convinced you in the end?
Well, what convinced me, first of all, I saw this film first when it just came out in Japan. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't believe it. I went with the top editor of Shogakukan and an academic from Gakushin University, and we were sitting there, and I thought, I can't believe I'm getting them to see an anime with me, you know, and they were so absorbed, they were crying, they were totally into it, and I loved it at first, but I hadn't really fully absorbed some of its messages, and also its slight ambivalence, but also skirting on the issues of in the 1930s of thought control of. Uh-huh. Build up to the war, of poverty, of a lot of decisions that were made and going towards the war. And so then looking at it again, I started looking at it a little bit more critically, all the tobacco that was being smoked on those trays, you know, and you just start looking at things. And then I was thinking a little bit more about certain stories that were left. So when they went to, the retreat and the German spy that was there, and you know, and you know, all these kind of dangling little bits. I started thinking a little bit more about them and feeling that they should have been tied together. But actually, now coming back and seeing it again, I realize what it is it's just a series of, in a way, dreamscapes that that come together. I have to say, just personally, two things that really always make me move me. And in fact, it brings me to tears. One is I worked at Tokyo University, and where they showed the fire, and also the sound, you know, when it goes roar. And I've been through a few earthquakes in Japan, but nothing major like that. But I've heard that it does make that sound. You know, people do say that it does make that sound. But I've sat a long time outside that Tokyo University library. My office was right next to it, that burnt up, and it still leaves a scar. That the books, they had fantastic libraries. They were all decimated. Everything was gone. It's the whole campus is redone from in the post-fire period. It really marks a huge break between the past and then the future Japan. And also on a personal level, I lived with my grandmother growing up, and she was dying of tuberculosis. And so I saw her gradually decline and die. And I have to say that the similarities are really moving. Yeah. You know, so there's this reality to this film that, you know, maybe a lot of you would realize or think about, but when you're physically, you know, in Tokyo, or when you physically see what he's portraying, it actually strikes a chord.
Yeah, that's something we may come to on this panel, this idea that Miyazaki, who was the great fantasy filmmaker, he had these great escapist classics from My Neighbor Totoro through Mononoke or Spirited Away, these fantasy worlds. This was his most grounded and historical film.
Karuizawa, where where they went for, you know, where he went, obviously, he was sent on a break. And in the very beginning of Karuizawa, you see a tennis scene with the girls playing tennis when he first goes there in the kind of this wooded cabin, and in the corner you see the tennis. I think that's a conscious reference to where the emperor who just retired met his wife on the tennis court in Karuizawa.
Okay.
So I think that there are constant little references throughout there.
This is what's so fascinating about these panels, is that Jake and I come at this as film critics and fans first and foremost. And I remember when this film came out, it was something that one of our previous panelists, Raida Denison, mentioned. When this film came out, most of the Western press skirted around the political controversy and were more horrified that there was so much smoking.
Yeah, well, I mean,
a Miyazaki film.
Before doing the podcast and like before going into a room with you to talk about it, I had no idea that this was a controversial film. But Alex, you lived in Japan as well, and like you, both of you obviously would have realized seeing this film how controversial it would have been.
I don't think it was only controversial in Japan. I remember it premiered at the Venice Film Festival, and someone on the jury said something to the effect that this film was diminished in their view because it was politically dodgy. So how is it politically dodgy? So just to recap, this film came out in Japan in 2013, and was instantly attacked by both the left and the right. by the right-wingers because they said it's too fatalistic about war. It makes war seem too much of a downer, about the Japanese national spirit. And attacked from the left because they said that the film was too kind to this person who is behind the Mitsubishi Zero plane, which was a killing machine used in Pearl Harbor, used in kamikaze attacks. So how did this confusion happen? I think it's interesting. If you read Miyazaki's writings and his interviews, he's a contradictory guy anyway. He constantly goes back on what he said about important issues. And probably his biggest contradiction is that he's an outspoken pacifist. And you see that, you feel that in his films, all his films, and you see that in his writing. And at the same time, he's obsessed with military machines and vehicles, and he's been drawing them basically since he was a child. And this film, The Wind Rises, is partly about this contradiction. And that's not me saying that. That's Toshio Suzuki, the big kind of producer, the guy who guides Studio Ghibli to some extent. When he was announcing this film at a press conference in Japan, he said, "We're making this film. I made Miyazaki make this film in order for him to confront this contradiction in him. Like, how can you love war machines while hating war?" And yeah.
No, and we spoke about this just now. You had your own way with this film that you almost flip-flopped in terms of your appreciation of it, right? Where do you sit with it now? And particularly this conflict.
I like it more and more when I see it. When I first saw it, it had just come out in France. And the storm of controversy had reached France. It was definitely a thing there as well. And it was so big that clouded my vision of the film. The whole way through, I was sitting there thinking, is this, you know, on what side, is Miyazaki wrong to depict this character in this way, or is he not? And the more I rewatch it, the more I see the richness of the themes apart from that, and the different ways in which Miyazaki plays with visual motifs. And I've realized it's actually one of his most kind of subtle and sophisticated films.
Yeah.
Alex, I think it was a couple of days before this screening, you tweeted about the fact that, well, even though in this very set of screenings we have shown a film in which raccoon dogs with magical testicles wage a war against industrial landscapers, you tweeted that you're excited to talk about the strangest Studio Ghibli film,
yeah,
The Wind Rises. Why do you think this is the strangest Studio Ghibli?
Strangest because I felt like I didn't know where I found it hard to know what Miyazaki was saying, and usually I don't have that with his films. Usually, however wacky the plots or the characters, you have a sense of a message kind of shining through, and the message is very consistent throughout his work. And in here, I think the message is basically the same. The things about, you know, how war is ultimately bad and destructive, and yet how throwing yourself with energy into something can be good. That's kind of the contradiction here. But it took me a while to realize that. I think basically where you stand on the film depends on large part on whether Jiro is a plausible character for you, whether he can be the designer of this killing machine while at the same time retaining enough integrity and dignity that we can admire him. And let's be honest, the film does admire him. The film is dedicated to him even. At the end, there's a dedication. And also, apart from this characterization of Jiro, it's also the question of, is Miyazaki allowed to make a film that uses this incredibly controversial period in Japanese history, the fascism and the war? Is he allowed to make a film about that without using that platform to more explicitly condemn the war? Just to kind of give a little bit more context on this, the climate in which this film came out in Japan was, the politics were very interesting. So Japan had this war, and then it never really kind of openly discussed and owned up to it in the way that, say, Germany did. People often say Japan has never apologized for the war officially. That's not quite true. There have been prime ministers in the 90s who very unambiguously said, what we did was wrong and we apologize to the countries who were victimized. But apologies don't necessarily last forever. And since the 90s, the country's kind of returned to the right more and more, become more nationalistic. Just months before this film came out in Japan, Shinzo Abe, the current prime minister, was elected for the first time on a platform of remilitarizing and restoring some of Japan's national pride. And obviously this stirred up a lot of support for him and a lot of anger from the other side, to the point where remilitarization, and just for context, Japan is constitutionally forbidden from having an army, the only country in the world that has that. But Shinzo Abe wants to change that and restore the military. And this issue has become more toxic than Brexit. And so anyone who's saying anything even tangential about the war is expected to really make a statement unambiguously about where they stand on this. Yeah. And The Wind Rises doesn't do that.
So how does Miyazaki come off creating a work like this? It's almost, is that naivety? Is that being stubborn? I don't know.
I think he knows exactly what he's doing. He's got to the point in his career where he's an outspoken person, and he has a message he wants to get across. And the message isn't, we need to not rebuild our army. Uh-huh. He's expressed that in articles that he wrote in tandem with the release of this film. But what he's saying in this film is how strange it is that humans can be this conflicted. Mm-hmm. How strange it is that they can essentially shut out a large part of that they can basically shut out their own responsibility for something. And I think he's kind of, you know, he said in an interview, like, if I was alive in the Second World War, or if I was an adult in the Second World War, I too would have gone along with the regime.
Right.
And that's not just hypothetical, because animators in the war were co-opted by the government to make propaganda. So he's really thinking he would have probably done that. He's saying it would have taken an enormous effort and a certain very specific character to rebel against that regime. And we shouldn't judge Jiro for not doing that. Yeah. And yet, at the same time, how sad it is that humans are that complex.
It's so fascinating. Yeah, exactly. It was so fascinating that all of this ancillary material exists, where Hayao Miyazaki, Isao Takahata, Toshio Suzuki, they're all writing books, publishing articles about the works they make, about each other's works, about the industry in general, about Japanese politics. We as international, maybe anglophonic, people who can't read or speak Japanese, we don't get that. We don't see that context. We just see this film. And the film has so many conflicts within it. Maybe part of this central conflict is the fact that this is a biography of Jiro Horikoshi. It's also a part adaptation of the novels of this lost generation who came of age during the war. It's also a pseudo semi-autobiography or apologia for Miyazaki's life as an artist, and how to square that with being a family man. And that creates quite a bit of friction for us in terms of how do you read this film. Is Jiro a sympathetic figure when he's there with his dying wife, but he also has one hand on his sketchbook at the same time?
I think it's
cigarette.
it's all of this that out of all the films that we've watched now for this series, with us like 18 films, this was the one where as soon as it finished, I was most curious to revisit it because of all of this stuff that you're not able to get on that first time viewing. Like, so much of this and your understanding of the films between both of you comes from that rewatch.
Could I just mention something, though, and maybe it's relevant or maybe it isn't relevant, but you had the wonderful Hosono Hitomi on the panel, this fantastic maniacal ceramic artist who did the wonderful manga ceramic in the British Museum, a manga exhibition, but also in the Japanese galleries. You see her thousand leaf vase, and her attention to detail, her fanaticism, her passion is overriding. It overrides her whole entire life. Mm-hmm. She is, you know, I'm sure she has fun too, but she works incredibly, incredibly hard. And that in general, from what I've seen working with a lot of craftspeople in Japan, that's my specialty is craft and ceramic, is this incredible detail, fidelity to material. They're very true to whatever material they've chosen, be it a creating an aircraft or be it porcelain. Mm. You know, so she's true to porcelain. She's not going to go dabble in stoneware. She's going to stick to that material and then just push it to this unbelievable extent until it's kind of perfect. And that, in fact, that obsession is very celebrated. And something that is actually, that you see with the Living National Treasures, you see it with her, you see with craftspeople that succeed. And it's very, very much appreciated. And it's actually almost one man, Murose Kazumi, who's a Living National Treasure with her lacquerware, and says that it goes back to Buddhist precepts and it goes back to the Heart Sutra. And he was actually, you know, talking about how this kind of dedication towards single-minded dedication is something that actually eventually frees your soul.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a running theme in Miyazaki's films. It's he's a pessimist and an optimist at the same time, if you can say that. He seems to say that the big picture is bleak. In a lot of his films, there's environmental despoliation, or there's war, or there's forces out of your control that are making the world a dark place. But on a small scale, you can make things good. And the way you can do that is by basically being passionate about something, or being dedicated to something. And one of the very last words in this film, he sees the ghost of Naoko saying to him, live. Mm-hmm. It's also the catchphrase of the poster in Japan, you have to live.
Yeah.
And that's actually often, the catchphrases of Japanese films often play on that word, live. Mm. You should live, we have to live, or something like that. It's this ability to find a kind of life force or energy in your métier or whatever it is, you know, that you've chosen, that can redeem you.
That's one of the uniting themes of many of his works, particularly the sort of post 9/11, post American invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan sort of films, where many of his production documents, and what I love about Miyazaki is he'd write this 3 or 4 page production document for all his films. They'd come down to the world is dying, but we must find reason to live within that simultaneous overarching pessimism, but small scale optimism.
Speaking of death and destruction, I'd love to tie this into what you're working on at the moment, Alex, your Grave of the Fireflies book. And when we spoke about this film before, we joked that this is secretly a Takahata film. This is the closest Miyazaki would come to making a Takahata film. Mm. How do you see them overlapping, particularly in The Wind Rises?
So I think we should explain what a Takahata film is for those who don't know his films. It's he was the other great director at Studio Ghibli, and he made films that were more realist, if you can say that, such a general word, but there were fewer elements of fantasy in his film. And his overriding concern was always to kind of maintain an objectivity from his characters and try and understand them in all their complexity. So he doesn't really do heroes, brave young kind of heroes, like Miyazaki often does. And people say that The Wind Rises is in kind of Takahata vibe, because it's set ostensibly in the real world. And Takahata did see this film and commented that of all Miyazaki's recent films, whatever he means by recent, this is the most watchable. At the same time, I don't see it as a Takahata film at all, really. As I said, Takahata kept this distance, like almost like a brushed in kind of distance, thinking, I must never get too close to my characters, otherwise I'll be blinded by their qualities and faults. And I feel like Miyazaki is a little bit guilty of that in this film. He really does romanticize Jiro, especially you see him in his early years, you know, defending little kids who are getting bullied. Those scenes seem pointless except to say, this guy is definitely a pacifist. Like, he really is, like, believe me. And he kind of, I think it's like he romanticizes him a bit too much. And as I said, he dedicates the film to him, which isn't necessary. And I think Takahata would disapprove of that. I think Takahata would have made a film with fewer dreams and less of a sense that Jiro has embarked on his own private fantasy of what his airplane should be, and more context that shows the problems of Jiro's enterprise with the plane.
You mentioning that this close relationship between the filmmaker and the character makes me remember that when I rewatched this very recently, there are certain outfits that Jiro wears which are very similar to pictures of young Miyazaki that you see, this particular sort of sweater that he wears. And you, I think I might have shared these on Twitter. You can have these side-by-side photographs between Jiro and Hayao, and they'd be wearing similar clothes. And I wonder if there's legs there with that reading at all. I like that one thing we do with this podcast is that I curated your path through Ghibli. We didn't go chronologically. We didn't necessarily go by popularity. And I saved this one until the mid-teens, right? And that was on purpose, because I feel that within The Wind Rises, there is a glimpse of almost every Miyazaki film to date.
This felt like the culmination, in a way, of what we had been working towards. Mm-hmm. Our most recent series ended with a double bill of The Tale of the Princess Kaguya, which would be our previous event or episode, and The Wind Rises tonight. And it was building up through the Takahata, who had never seen a film of his before either, and just building up to what at the time was both of their final films.
And I wonder, Alex, if once we get past, if you were able eventually to look past this political debate around the film, do you see the strains of DNA or the ambitions of Miyazaki, the animator, that maybe culminate in this, which at the time he said, this was going to be my final film, I can't make another one after this. I left everything on the stage. What's the term there? I left everything on the table? Whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely... I mean, the obvious thing is flight. Miyazaki's always been obsessed with flight. He's been obsessed with this, harking back to this kind of pre-war, pre-industrial Japan where the environment, everything is still in its right place and society hasn't encroached too far. And this film is a tribute to that as well, because you see these rolling green fields, you know, that are still relatively untouched by modern society.
Up until this point, for me, that the best single moment that Miyazaki had ever done was the planes above the clouds in Porco Rosso.
I agree.
The plane graveyard sequence. I don't know if anyone out there has seen Porco Rosso, but it's your favourite of his films, and I think...
Yeah, and it is this incredible moment where above the clouds there is this circling heaven of wonderful aeroplanes, and this feels like, well, the closest we would get. I know there was a mooted Porco Rosso sequel, but stylistically, that wonderful dreamlike approach to aeroplanes, obviously this film is chock full of that. So for me, that was wonderful.
And we've started with almost this deeper political, contextual, cultural reading of the film, but there are so many more fan-based readings or maybe superficial readings of this where you can play spot the reference. What I love is that the Italian aviation designer who's in this, Caproni, one of his most famous pieces of work was the Ghibli, which is what, of course, they named the studio after, which is an amazing little sort of self-reference there. He doesn't mention it, but it's there for people who know to look for the signs.
I think what I got rewatching this film this week was the richness of the wind imagery and just the way that they play with this idea. So obviously the wind blows the hat, you know, it connects the lovers. The wind is carried by the earthquake, so it's destruction as well.
But it was the sound of the wind that came to the studio's name as well.
So the Ghibli is also the Sirocco winds, the winds of the Northern Sahara. So yes, exactly.
Yeah, it's the name of the wind, which then gave its name to the Italian plane, which then gave its name to the studio. But it also occurred to me that winds, the planes that Jiro designed, their fate was to be used as kamikaze planes in the dying days of the war. And kamikaze, it means divine wind. It's named after the giant winds that repelled the Mongol invaders in the 12th century or 13th century, whenever it was. And so, you know, the wind has this kind of dark portent as well. And then one thing I noticed, which I'd never noticed before, was in, I think it was the Jiro's boss's house, there's a panel on the ceiling with calligraphy on it. And the calligraphy says, "Great wind up above." And I looked it up, and it's a Buddhist proverb, which essentially means, whatever you might feel like's going on down here, up there there's always a mighty wind blowing, and that mighty wind, the symbolic meaning is the compassion of the Buddha. And so things will turn out all right, you know, you've always got the wind of the Buddha blowing above you. What else? Yeah, there's just wind everywhere.
all around us at all times.
But also what you're saying makes a lot of sense about this kind of revival, because really the whole point of the train trip and then that great Tokyo earthquake that happened in the 20s, I mean, it really destroyed your huge swaths of Tokyo, and he clearly showed that. And then there was the comment that the city, when they were taking the riverboat, that the city had already been rebuilt, and explaining a little bit about how, you know, the buildings were the same, but the streets were widened, but the city had, you know, suddenly been rebuilt. So it's almost, so this kind of, from disaster comes rebuilding, and then again comes the disaster, and then, you know, perhaps a rebuilding after that. So it's this kind of cycle.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's almost harks to Princess Kaguya's final theme about the water wheel always turning, this sense of the cycle of rebirth. When I saw, I was very fortunate to see The Wind Rises at Venice, and then the following year I saw The Tale of Princess Kaguya at Toronto Film Festival, but both making their international debuts. The emotion of watching those two films are overwhelming, because they both deal with death and legacies and what may come next and how you'll be remembered. Mm. And they're two filmmakers very seriously dealing with those questions. And then Miyazaki now goes out and makes another film that's coming out next year.
Yeah, I did actually watch the trailer for this one, and it was quite funny to see it marketed as the final masterpiece.
The Wind Rises, yes. Alex, something we've asked almost every panelist along these Q&As is just where Ghibli fits into their worldview. And I think your intersection between your education and living in Japan and your Japan focus, but then also working almost on the deep industry side of animation. Where does Studio Ghibli fit within all that? Is it seen as old hats? Is it seen as quite conventional? Are people excited for this new film next year?
Yeah, I think Ghibli still commands a lot of respect. I mean, massive respect. It's by far the most famous Japanese animation studio. In Japan, interestingly, Ghibli have always been at pains to differentiate themselves from the rest of the industry. They refuse to call their films anime. They say, we make mangaiga, which basically means manga films. And that's not a comment really on their relationship with manga so much as just a useful way to differentiate themselves from other anime, which they see as more cheaply made, which is generally true. More obsessed with violence and robots and sex, which is also generally true, and more limited in the animation, kind of less smooth and sophisticated. So in Japan, Ghibli, well, it's, you know, it's even bigger and more important than it is here in the UK by far. But it kind of they try to distinguish themselves as well as. As for where it stands in the. I think the thing I keep thinking about is what is going to happen now, because Miyazaki is working on another film, but surely that will be his last. Surely. He's 78 now. Takahata died last year. And the studio is so identified with them that it can't go on in any recognizable form once they're both gone. And Miyazaki admits as much in this documentary about the making of The Wind Rises called The Kingdom of Dreams and Madness. At one point, he's asked, he's standing on the rooftop of Studio Ghibli looking out over Tokyo and having a sentimental moment with a cigarette. Always the cigarettes.
With the studio cat.
The studio cat. And he's asked, what's going to happen to Studio Ghibli? And he says, it's all going to come crashing down. And the way he says it just makes me think of Jiro looking at his, crashed planes at the end. This kind of fatalistic sense that you can try your best, and yet in the end, bigger forces will always decide things on your behalf. It's so clear in so many of his films, and here he just states it explicitly in the film.
Yeah. He's such a grump.
Yeah, he's such a grump. Yeah, he really is.
Did we have someone down here who wanted to make a statement or a question? Would you have a microphone coming your way?
It was really interesting to hear you talk about the film and about the politics and all that, because for me, I was just watching it as something nice, something interesting. And I understand why you would want to make it political, but I think it's also just a bit of history.
Well, that was totally my reaction as well, because I didn't have any of this knowledge whatsoever, and that was purely my viewing of it until we went into a recording studio and I got my lecture about all the context behind it.
And that also speaks to how these films are released and marketed internationally, particularly in the United States and here. They're released by companies that, when they were first, when their first films they released were Ghibli, would be kids' films, family films, and then they enter into these year-long deals, multi-picture deals, and then they're given this film, and they think, "How do I release this at the Easter holidays for the kids?" And but then that's how it's presented. You have a poster where it's a guy looking up at the clouds with his hat being blown off his head, and we don't see that.
It's worth saying here that Toshio Suzuki, the producer I mentioned, who basically guides Ghibli's marketing strategy, was worried that this film would only appeal to men. So he packaged a four-minute trailer, which only shows, but basically almost entirely shows the love, the romance scenes, and played that in cinemas in the run-up to the release of the film. And he credits that strategy with like doubling the audience and bringing in loads more money than the film expected to make.
To appeal to
women, he said as much himself, yeah. But there was a lot of anxiety, even in Japan, where Miyazaki is a god, that this was not really a Miyazaki film. Like, what is too adult? It's too realistic. Like, how do you market it? Same in the US. I think Disney normally distribute Ghibli films, but there they put it under the Touchstone label, which is more like adult oriented stuff.
But I just to go back to, you know, your point, I do think though, we can read it on many different levels, as anything can be read on many different levels, but it does show a very interesting swath of Japanese history or landscape, maybe not history so much as landscape, from the 20s through the 30s. Mm. And the poverty that it showed, the people on the railway line, the build-up. I mean, it was very, very hard in the 20s and 30s. And I think you feel that. I mean, you get a real sense of, it seems incredibly accurate, the drawings of Tokyo, the signs. You know, even, you know, when talking about, you know, the really old-fashioned type of cake that he had purchased, you know, and tried to give to the two children that were waiting for their parents, and they, that's just a really kind of retro cake that was popular in the early 20th century, so by saying, oh, you've got interesting eating habits. I mean, you can still buy it in Tokyo, but it's really like Victorian sponge cake, you know. But it's so I think that there you can enjoy this experience looking at it.
But it's a slice of history, but it's also intended to reflect the modern day. Miyazaki often drew parallels in interviews between the 30s, which you're seeing in the film, and now. He says, you know, there was rising militarism, nationalism then. Now there's the risk of the same. There was a trauma for the country then, which was the earthquake. And then recently there's been the earthquake and the tsunami in 2011. There was a recession then. Japan's in an economic slump now. And he seems to be saying to, you know, to all the people out there, especially the young people watching this film, this has all happened before, and there's a way to make life worth living, which is design military airplanes. to find your passion and try and survive, basically live, as they say. Yeah,
that's what's fascinating about Miyazaki, though. You can enjoy these films on the level. When I first saw it, I enjoyed it on a similar level to you, but then if you think about anyone similar in the Western film industry, Ken Loach or somebody who may be making grand political statements about the here and now, even when he makes period films set in 19th century Ireland and he's talking about now, you can't. They're not necessarily films that can be enjoyed by people from ages 6 to 60, are they?
And Ken Loach is much more didactic, though.
No, of course. I'm just talking about the way you're talking about Miyazaki. Like, he's saying this and he's laying out these arguments and these themes, but there's whole swaths of the audience.
I don't know what you're saying, Michael. I would go Teletubbies Cares every day.
Exactly.
But I think that this film is so complex and nuanced that not many people could actually make it, because it would be too difficult to pitch, and Miyazaki's just reached a point in his career where he can make whatever he wants, because his films are so popular, and you know, he doesn't have an editor, you know. I mean, I'm sure he does, but he can more or less write the script as he wants, follow his instincts, say what he wants and it will be approved.
Sorry, may I say something else?
Of course.
So, because I want to defend Giro a little bit. So he was studying in 1923, because that's when the great earthquake was. So he didn't set out to make military airplanes. He just set out to make airplanes.
Mm. Well,
and then Japan became more military in 1931 and on. So what choice did he have? Should he not have made airplanes?
And he's clearly, I think he's obviously against the use that they have, because there's a great bit when they're designing them and they are failing, and he says, well, they'd just work if we could take the guns off. And I think that's Jiro's thought process.
Or is that Miyazaki's hand tilting it towards the idealization of industry without the military industrial complex?
I don't know how much choice he had in, you know, Jiro, the actual Jiro. I mean, it's in build up to the wartime. For example, for ceramicists, if you wanted to have your kiln, if you wanted to fire any ceramics, because ceramics take a lot of resource, water, wood, a lot of resource, you had to fire works that were for the war effort. Mm-hmm. So you had to fire ceramics that are hand grenades or landmines and all of that. And potters didn't necessarily want to make those works, but they had to work. And they couldn't fire other ceramics unless they fired those ceramics. So I just don't know. When you start to look, it's almost easy for us to think that there were some choices that could have been made. I think it's much harder if you're in that period.
That's really fascinating. Thank you so much for those comments. Any final comments before?
It's just one at the back.
Right at the back there, right second row.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast. Alongside my good friend, John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm back.
Hi, I just wanted to actually just follow on from that, because it feels like the one thing that you haven't talked about so much is Jiro and the representation of him in the film. This first time I've seen it, but I mean, there seems to be this kind of, both this sort of romanticism to him, but also this kind of awkwardness that comes out regularly in sort of social situations. And I'm not sure whether that's just a translation issue in that, you know, I'm misunderstanding how that character would come across to a Japanese audience, or whether that is sort of like baked into the character. And if that is also one of these kind of strategies for making him seem a bit more sympathetic to us as an audience.
Well, there's one very specific way that he's awkward. He's voiced by a non-professional voice actor. He's actually voiced by Hideaki Anno, who is an animator that worked with Miyazaki early in his career and went off. And he's almost the only Miyazaki protege who went and ploughed his own furrow.
Yeah.
He went and created Neon Genesis Evangelion in his own right.
Mamoru Oshii as well.
Yeah.
But
Alex, Nicole, any thoughts on that, about the sympathetic nature of Jiro?
Yeah, he's almost sociopathically shut off from his emotions. The thing that struck me when I watched it recently was I don't really buy his love affair with Naoko. When he sees her, he doesn't remember her at all from the train. And yet later on, he confesses to her that he's always loved her since the moment he saw her on the train. I don't know if that's just bad scripting or if that's deliberately meant to say something about him actually being quite insincere when he says he loves her. And that's certainly sustained by other things he does, like keeping on working and smoking while she's dying next to him.
Don't you think that, though, he's living a fantasy life? And so in a way, you know, from the very beginning, when he used the very early scene when he has his, you know, he's a young boy and, you know, he has this fantasy of flying off. And so everything is always kind of, sometimes it's hard to see what is the reality and what is the fantasy. It's always slightly blurred. And so in a way, this relationship with Naoko could be, you know, it is part of his fantasy, and so it just kind of almost becomes that. It doesn't matter if it's real or not. So I don't know whether it's completely cynical. I think it's just, he just creates this fantasy of this relationship, and it's telling that his friend says, "Oh, I'm going off to get married tomorrow," and because you need to get married, and so it's almost like this idea that, oh, you know, this is what you need to go forward. And so then he does that and creates this, you know, fantasy. So I didn't see it as cynical. I felt it's just, he just doesn't have a blurring between the reality and not. And that's why he could not see that his wife was dying and he couldn't see what was going to happen.
Interesting. I find it really interesting, Alex, that you mentioned that subplot was almost mandated by Suzuki, because I feel that Miyazaki's not interested in that character of Naoko.
Well, she just gets forgotten about for an hour.
You think about his entire filmography up to this point, Kiki's Delivery Service, Spirited Away, Princess Mononoke, great female characters, both in lead and supporting roles that are allowed to do whatever they want, break out of all societal boundaries. This is a character who he marries and then she dies.
Yeah.
In contrast to his sister, who is so full of life and can go and have her own
sister
career.
Is much more Miyazaki-ish than...
Yeah, I wonder if it's just that he's not as interested in that.
Yeah, she seems like a vessel for just to kind of reinforce this idea that it was a difficult time, tuberculosis was everywhere, and, you know, the Jiro was battling against greater forces than he could manage. Disease, war... The planes are doomed, Naoko's doomed. It feels like he's just trying to kind of symbolically tie it together. And I wonder what the film would be like if the Naoko plotline was cut. It would be shorter.
Speaking of things running long.
Speaking of short.
Yes. We do need to wrap up now. We've had such a really fascinating panel. Thank you so much for your questions. Alex, Nicole, thank you so much for joining us this evening. And one more thing. Behind these screenings has been Bryony Smith, one of the programmers for the adult program here. Thank you so much, Bryony.
Thank you, Bryony.
And thank you, everyone, for coming. Have a safe journey home.
Thank you to Nicole and Alex there for joining us on our last of our British Museum live episodes.
It's been a very fun summer, hasn't it, Jake?
It really has. Podcasts truly are beautiful dreams, aren't they, Michael?
you've used that before, I think.
I'll use it again.
But what are we going to do now? Are we retiring?
No, not just yet. We can't do that. This is a Ghibli show. No one ever retires, really.
We're going to be brought back out of retirement for a final miniseries of films. Well, let's never say final.
No.
But we do have a handful of films left in the current Ghibli library that we need to get to.
Yeah, and I mean, these are some true deep cuts. I know you've shielded me from a lot of stuff. You front-loaded the series with the big hitters, and now we're really getting down into it, into the murky, muddy waters.
Exactly, the likes of Ocean Waves, My Neighbours the Yamadas, some pre-Ghibli films like Little Norse Prince. Do you like Lupin? We've got Castle of Cagliostro coming up. Jake, do you have any understanding of what you're in for?
Well, what I'm really excited about is, as we all know, Tales from Earthsea, a very good film. And I'm just excited to hear what the director's up to next.
Exactly. So we do have From Up on Poppy Hill as well. You're teasing very well there. But anyway, in the meantime, if you want to keep up with us, we are both on Twitter. You can follow Jake at Jake H. Cunningham.
And Michael at Michael J. Leader.
Bibliotech is a Little Dot Studios production. Our music is made by Anthony Ng, our artwork is by Sophie Moe, and Jamie Mazner is our audio wizard. The show is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Steph Watts, and Harold McShiel.